Welcome to Civil Defense Radio with your host, Preston Schleinkofer. Civil Defense Radio is more than just a podcast about a new American civil defense structure. Through our total media presence, our website, Facebook, and Twitter pages, we work to inform you of the many serious threats, both natural and man-made, that our nation faces. Those issues many news agencies are afraid to speak about or unwilling to mention. We believe this total information approach will assist you in making the best possible decisions about the safety and security for yourself, your family, your neighborhood, and your community during disastrous events. Civil defense equals resiliency equals survival. To be resilient, it takes preparation, organization, and training to meet the needs of whatever situation we may find ourselves in. Civil defense helps reduce panic in a disaster, and we want to be part of your preparation. We strongly recommend establishing a community-based civil defense organization in your city or county in partnership with your local emergency manager and community leaders. We offer guidance on our website at civildefenseradio.com under the Resources tab. Look for the guide at the top of the page. It is enough information to get the discussion started, and also, we are always here to help. We ask you to regularly download and listen to our shows and visit our web and social media platforms often at civildefenseradio.com, on Facebook at Civil Defense Radio, and on Twitter at civil_def_radio. Now let's get on with our show. This week we are talking with Matthew West. He is a risk manager with the Texas Office of Risk Management and is a reserve deputy sheriff with the Medina County Sheriff's Office. He has over 19 years of law enforcement experience and worked as a state police officer and a special agent with the Union Pacific Railroad Police. He has worked as a first responder in several large-scale disasters such as hurricanes, tornadoes, and flooding events. You can contact him on LinkedIn. And Matthew, welcome to the show, brother.
Thank you very much, Preston. I greatly appreciate it. It's an honor to be on the show, and I want to thank you for doing everything that you're doing, dedicating your time and resources to get the message out to people. Thank you.
Well, thank you. You know, not only are you a brother officer, but you're also a brother border lawman on some of the same streets in South Texas that I worked.
Absolutely. When I learned about where you've been and what you did in the past, I thought, well, I'm sure there are several times our paths probably crossed, and, you know, we didn't even know it.
Yeah, more than likely. Those were the days. They're even crazier now. But those days down in South Texas, man, my blood is still green from Border Patrol, you know? It was a great time. And a bad time at the same time. You know, you know how it goes, man. Sometimes those days of work are just so long that you just wonder, is this day ever going to end?
Especially when it's August and you're working on a day shift, man. Those were some long, long days.
Yeah, it gets hot down there. I remember tracking aliens across the desert at 115. You know, it's nothing compared to the sandbox over in Middle East that our military has dealt with. For local U.S. side work, that's pretty good.
Absolutely.
You know, I just read your bio, a brief description of it, and we're going to be talking about a couple things that you've written. First, we're going to be talking about a guest post that you had on a friend of ours, Michael Mabee's website, and then we're going to also talk about your great thesis that you wrote for your master's degree. I love that thesis. You wrote about things in such depth that it should be mandatory reading for anybody in the emergency management field. It is such a great work. I hope they gave you extra points for it.
Well, I appreciate it. I'm very humbled by that. I worked very hard on that thesis, and I did actually end up graduating with honors, and part of that was part of that thesis that I did. But, you know, the articles I've done, the thesis, I posted a link here recently on LinkedIn as well. And, you know, these are writings that I feel very passionate about. You know, responding to these disasters, and I know you've responded to similar disasters, probably some of the same disasters I responded to, and you see the initial devastation, the lack of preparedness. You know, people just take things for granted. And I think we need to get the word out, the awareness that, look, you know, you need to be prepared. You can't just sit on your hands and think everything's fine. You know, disaster happens, and in an hour or two, the lights are going to be back on. Help's going to be there. You're going to have food, water, shelter. It just doesn't work that way. And some of these even smaller scale disasters highlighted that. And that's what I really wanted to put out to the public and to my fellow citizens and mankind that, look, we are responsible for our own well-being.
That's right. And FEMA's even said, to some degree, you know, this 72 hours that we told you to prepare for, well, we may not be able to get to you in that period of time. So it might be better if you have a little bit more. Well, I say a lot more, because why should you be a victim voluntarily? All you got to do is plan ahead a little bit, and you can start stocking up stuff and filling up your closets and stuff like that. You just need to be ready.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, more and more relief agencies are really putting that message out. It used to be the three-day supply. That was a lot of it, because the thought was, well, you'll have supplies within 3 days. Well, then after big disasters such as Katrina, Hurricane Sandy, even Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, you know,
yeah,
it opened people's eyes, and it's like, well, wait a minute. You know, I've got 3 days supply of food, water, but it's going to be a week before anybody gets to me.
Yeah.
You know, people on Katrina were stuck in the attics of the house sometimes for a week, week and a half before that they even got anybody out there, before the water was able to go down. So, you know, it's not like this hasn't happened before, and that our eyes haven't been opened up to this type of disaster. It has, but, you know, that's the one thing about here in America is, for some reason, you know, we'll rally around, a disaster will happen, we'll do everything we can, we'll come together, but 5-10 years down the road, it's like we forget any of the lessons that we learned.
Yeah. Well, that's because, one, we as a nation, we're too busy, and we don't think about, you know, that was yesterday. Today's sunshine, you know, we don't have to worry about it. But in reality, we have to worry about it every day, because there's threats that are lurking out there in the darkness, literally, that could bite us in the butt any time, and it would be a lot worse than a Katrina or a Sandy or a Harvey or anything, you know, even Maria. You know, Maria was only bad because it hit a small island. It devastated them, but at the same time, if Maria would have hit the mainland, it wouldn't have been any worse than Harvey. Matter of fact, it may not have been as bad as Harvey or even Katrina.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, and kind of an ironic point to that is, one of my good friends, who's a border patrolman that's originally from Puerto Rico, I went to go visit their family one year, and, you know, he's talking about, oh, you know, we're in Puerto Rico, we're used to hurricanes, our houses are all cinder block, and, you know, hurricane comes in, we wash them out, you know, we get back to work the next day. But when Maria came in and took the grid out, it created a whole different scenario. It was something that they totally were not used to.
Yeah, and weren't prepared for, because it may have not happened to that scale before. It may have gone down for a day or two, but not for months. And, you know, in some places, it's still not up in some real rural areas of the islands.
Yeah, I mean, some of those areas, if you've never been to Puerto Rico, it's very, for a small island, there's some very remote, very hard to get to locations. You know, there's a rainforest there.
Yeah.
It's just almost impossible to get through it without having to put some intense labor into it.
Yes. Yes, you're right. You know, I'm going to say right up front here to anybody who's listening, or everybody who's listening, is Matthew is a subject matter expert on disaster. His thesis is his expertise. The work that he put into that document to get the information relayed on paper, he had to have read hours and hours and hours of documents and sifted through fact versus fiction in order to come to the conclusion that he did in his work there. There's no doubt in my military mind that you are a subject matter expert on disaster.
Well, I appreciate that. You're right. It did. The thing on the thesis is that when I was doing my research, so much of it, even though it was open source, was so deeply buried.
Yeah.
That I was digging and digging and digging and digging and digging and digging and trying to find any remote amount of resources I could, especially on the electromagnetic pulse. The military research, the stuff that's been done since the nuclear testing back, after World War II or during and after World War II. And then some of the findings I found was, we've known about this since the 40s.
Yeah.
And we have done really nothing to prepare for it.
Yeah. Well, there's various theories on that. But the public needs to understand is these threats, and I list them on our website, is life-changing. There's been some things that have happened, and you highlight them, Metcalf and things like that, that could have been a dry run. Many people in the special ops community think it was. So it's something that people really need to understand, that there are some things out there that they're not being told, and it's not conspiracy theory. It's fact, because the government has spent 20 years and billions of dollars to study these threats, and because of politics, they can't get anything done.
Correct, because it's going to cost money.
Exactly.
Bottom line, it's going to cost money, but I'm a firm believer in if it's going to alter my daily way of life, I'm willing to put a few extra dollars down in my electric bill and taxes, whatever the case may be, in order to still be able to turn that light switch on in the morning. Living in South Texas, I love my central heat and air unit.
Yeah.
Especially right now when, temperatures are around 100 degrees. And if we lose our grid, we lose everything. And, I know your listeners probably know about the Internet of Things and how everything is so interlaced. I was talking to my kids the other day, trying to explain to them about how intricate everything is now compared to what it was even 20 years ago. Technology has just grown so much that it's intertwined itself into everything we do. And it's like a big Jenga set.
Yeah.
If you take a piece out here, it may not do anything. You take a piece out here, but you don't know what piece is going to cause it to collapse. So when it collapses, the whole thing comes down.
Yeah, well,
not just one part of it.
Look at where the military's at with their squad-based communications and tracking and stuff. I mean, they've got handhelds that they use for all kinds of things just at the squad level. And so, stuff like that can be affected on the battlefield by an EMP. So if we are so dependent on the mobile devices and things like that for defense, what about our water, our sanitation, our gasoline and electricity and things like that, things that we have to have in order to live a modern life because of electricity?
Oh, absolutely. You talk about water. If you're not aware, Austin had an issue with the water during flooding several months ago.
No, I hadn't heard that.
Well, and I was very surprised to see that Austin, the city of Austin proper, gets its drinking water from one source, and it's one of the lakes. And because of the massive flooding that we had, that the water was so turbid that the filters couldn't filter properly. Mm-hmm. They're getting clogged up. So the city issued a citywide boil notice. Now, I grew up in a small South Texas town. In fact, in early 2000, we had a tornado come through, take out our substation, our power substation. We were without electricity for about a week and a half. And didn't think anything of it. We still had a little bit of water pressure. We knew it wasn't treated. We boiled the water and went on with life.
Right.
When they had to post instructions on how to boil water for people, I just sat there beside myself.
How do you not know how to boil water?
That's what I said. But the news media was actually putting releases out on, you know, how to boil water, how long you have to boil it for. And again, I grew up in rural America, rural South Texas. I was in Scouts. You know, I was fortunate enough to have my grandparents around who lived through the Great Depression and World War II and knew about rationing and survival.
Yes.
And to me, I took it for granted that, well, everyone knows that boiling water kills disease and makes it safer to drink. Yet, here these people were panicking. I mean, people were buying out supermarkets with bottled water. I mean, they were just coming in and doing a run on water, sometimes within about a 30 to 40 mile radius around the city of Austin, because people were panicking because, oh my goodness, we're not going to have drinking water.
It's called filter and boil.
Yes. I walked in the office. I filled my water bottle up and someone's panicking. You can't drink that. You can't drink that. I looked at them. I opened my bug out bag and pulled out my water treatment tablets, threw it in there. I said, well, in 30 minutes, I'm going to have water. You know, to me, it was nothing. But, you know, people were generally freaking out about this. They didn't know what to do. And I thought, you know, this is just a boil of water. It's not like in India right now where you have a true water shortage where your reservoirs have completely dried up.
Mm.
You know, you still have electricity. You still have food. But that right there just showed me how vulnerable we are if we're panicking over having to boil water.
Right, right. Let's shift gears here to this article that you wrote as a guest poster on Michael Mabee's website. Title is Pinehurst, Texas, What Resilience Looks Like. This was my introduction to Matthew West. And when I read this, I go, I got to talk to this guy. So can you tell us about that, about your experience there and give us a little insight into microgrids?
Absolutely. I didn't work Hurricane Katrina. I was in law enforcement at that time. I was a county deputy. In fact, I was working with a mutual friend of ours. And when I got on with the Alcoholic Beverage Commission as a state police officer, we would still respond as first responders to major state emergencies. And Hurricane Rita was my very first major hurricane to work. And, you know, I listened to all my law enforcement friends that did go deploy at Katrina. You know, I'm one of those, I like after action reports, and I learned from them. I learned from what they had and didn't have. And, you know, I was stationed in Del Rio at the time. And for those not familiar with the geography of Texas, it is a 12-hour drive from Del Rio, Texas, to the Beaumont Port Arthur area where Pinehurst is located in that general area, and Orange, West Orange, is some of the smaller cities around Beaumont Port Arthur there. And so we get a call, you know, hey, we're going to deploy. First of all, I knew just from working in government long enough that we probably weren't as well supplied as we were going to be told we were. So I went to Border Patrol and I went to Customs and I had some contacts there and I ended up taking my Crown Vic. I was almost dragging the mufflers on it when I had MREs. I had night vision, copious amounts of water, and plus everything I normally carry, on an outpost. I'm by myself and I had everything from Sonora, Texas down to Eagle Pass and I worked by myself. So you can imagine, I had enough supplies to last me 3 days if my car broke down. And, we get out there, and we show up to the Orange City Hall. And, you know, it's this beautiful, newly built city hall. It's got the police department located in there. And I remember driving up. Now, keep in mind, I've been up since 4:30 in the morning. We're rolling into town about 5 p.m., we get there, we set up, my supervisors go in to get the command briefing, and they come out and say, well, congratulations, we're working 12-hour shifts, and our shift starts in 1 hour. So I've got a 24-hour day ahead of me.
Oh, boy.
But I'm looking at this building, I'm looking outside, and there's like 35 porta-potties that they brought out there they were able to expedite. And keep in mind, this is 12 hours after the eye of the hurricane came through.
Right.
So they already had some things pre-staged, ready to go. We get there. Part of the roof is blown off the city hall, so you can't use part of it. You walk into the city council chambers. They've got like 1,200 law enforcement in there that are hot sheeting it. Just, you know, when one shift ends, the other's leaving. So you can imagine the smell because there's no running water.
Right.
The sewage is backed up because there's no wastewater treatment because, well, there's no electricity.
Right.
And I think to myself, oh, this is going to be a miserable couple of weeks. You know, so my partner and I, we hop in the car and we start a patrol. Sun goes down and I keep seeing this orange glow off in the distance. And I'm thinking to myself, is that a fire? But I notice, you know, there's no dancing flames. It's not moving. It's just a steady glow. And I turn to my partner. I said, those are municipal city lights. Those are the amber street lights you see in cities. I said, somebody has electricity because as far as we knew, within about a 150-mile radius, power was completely out.
Hmm.
So we start driving through yards and, you know, trying to dodge trees and power lines, and we finally get up to the city of Pinehurst. And my theory was right. You know, those orange lights are city municipal lights. And the city of Pinehurst has an all-in-one building that's fire, EMS, city hall, the police department, public works. It's all in one little complex that's a large metal building.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, it did good. It survived the hurricane. So I remember we come driving up, and I walk into the back of the police department, and I see this uniformed police officer sitting there with about a 2 or 3 day growth of beard, just looked like he hadn't slept, looked like a zombie. And I remember he looks at me and goes, who the hell are you?
I'm the government. I'm here to help.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I said, well, we're TABC. We've been assigned to patrol Pinehurst. That is our assignment. And he looks at me. He goes, how many other people do you have in your unit? I said, well, we've got like 10 or 12. I can't remember how many we had at that time. But, you know, we have this amount. He goes, well, good. That's about all I can sleep in my city hall. He says, everybody has forgotten about us. We have not had any communication in 3 days. Nobody has called or driven or helicopter or anything to see if we're even still alive over here. If you patrol my area, you leave my officers so they can be with their families. We'll let you sleep here. You know, we have air conditioning. We have water. We have sewage.
And this is after the hurricane has rolled through and knocked everybody else out.
Absolutely. This is 12 hours after the hurricane. And I looked at them, and I could hear generators running. I hear one that's kind of missing on a cylinder or two. And I asked them, I said, that was a good foresight to have some generators, you know, but what are you going to do about diesel? Because I'm already thinking logistics.
Right,
you know, roads
right.
are blocked. They already told us fuel is going to be slim to none for at least 2 or 3 days before they get roads cleared out. So he tells me, he says, oh, I want to show you something. And he shows me this map. And over at the natural gas plant, he says, see that here? This is a generator. He says, now this is the only diesel generator I have. What we did is we came out from the natural gas and we did a cutoff valve where just as it happened on, you know, when the trees get uprooted, it pops the power or the gas lines. So we're able to shut it off to the main city, but we ran another line from here to City Hall and all the critical infrastructure. So all those generators you heard were running on natural gas that are being powered by our diesel generator. That had, and I don't remember how many thousands of gallons of fuel they had, but it was more than most places have.
Right.
You know, they were probably good for about at least 2 weeks if they needed to. And it worked. I mean, they had a full functioning city utilities going.
Hmm.
And it was so nice to be able to take a hot shower. And, you know, it's my guys that I was working with, you know, they were extremely happy because, you know, it's one thing to be in Southwest Texas along the Rio Grande until you get down to about Brownsville, that area.
Right.
But if you've been in South Texas in the summertime along the coast, it's not only hot, but it is miserably humid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there was nothing better than coming in at, you know, 06:30, coming in the door, being able to go take a nice shower, and then go into a very cold city hall chambers where you grab your sleeping bag and can rack out for, you know, 8 to 12 hours before you had to get up and do it all over again.
That sounds like an extreme luxury in those conditions.
It was, and the only condition we had was don't tell anybody else, because if they don't, if they weren't, you know, couldn't come check on us, then you know what, y'all came out here, you checked on us. This is kind of my gift to you, and believe me, we didn't tell anybody.
Yeah.
And had word gotten out, you know, it would have attracted more and more people. You know, they didn't really have any food. The food that they're eating was actually, all the first responders that stayed there were cleaning out their freezers.
Right, right. Let's take a quick break, and we'll be back in a minute to follow up on this point you were just making. Hey, friends, please allow me to speak with you about something you may want to add to your regular health maintenance routine, as well as your preparedness supplies. A few years ago, I came across an article in a preparedness magazine that caught my attention. My wife and I have always been health conscious, and we have taken various supplements over the years. However, this article introduced us to the world of essential oils. My wife began researching to find a reputable company with high-quality products. What she found was a company that we have been with now for about 4 years, using their products, many of them daily. The company is doTERRA, and their products are certified pure, therapeutic-grade essential oils. Essential oils come in all grades on the scale, but doTERRA oils are, in our opinion, at the top. Sure, you can go to Walmart or the local pharmacy and purchase essential oils, but not many of them are recommended for internal use. Many of our oils can be used orally, topically, and diffused for their wonderful aromatic fragrance and health benefits. Some of our favorites we use almost daily are lemon, clove, frankincense, lavender, En Garde blend, peppermint, and melaleuca, also known as tea tree oil. These oils have become our go-to remedies for managing our health throughout the year. In fact, we credit our oils for our overall good health. You can too. Just visit our website at www.oilsforlifetoday.com. That's oils, number 4, lifetoday.com, and explore the wonderful world of certified pure, therapeutic-grade essential oils for yourself. And welcome back to the show. We're talking to Matthew West, and he's telling us about his experience in Pinehurst, Texas. So if you would, sir, continue on with what you were talking about you came back from patrol and took a good nap and air conditioning, and there was food there.
Yes, there was food, and they had a bunch of MREs rattled back in the corner, and, you know, in case food supplies really started getting thin. But, you know, the first few days, you know, people were new enough, you know, been enough through hurricanes to know that, hey, you know, we're going to lose power, so get the duct tape out, duct tape the seal on your deep freeze to keep it cold as long as you can. And but as things, you know, day 2, 3, and 4 started rolling along, things started falling out. So, you know, these families were bringing in food, and, I mean, we were eating good. We're having steaks. We're having stew. But, you know, you quickly realize that, okay, two things are going to happen. Number one, we're going to run out of fresh food at some point, and or it's going to go bad. Even though we had limited refrigeration just because we didn't have power in that little municipal complex, you know, the rest of the city didn't have power. The other takeaway I took from it was family. That was the chief's big thing. When we came in, it was like a big relief off his shoulders, because now he could send those officers that couldn't go home, that were assigned, you know, to stay through the hurricane. And even those that, you know, were staying at their home, they're, you know, a lot of their houses, the roofs got ripped off, there's holes in them. Of course, they have no electricity, no water, nothing. So these first responders, firefighters, EMTs, public works, police officers, they're there with their families. And, I mean, spouses, children, some of them have elderly family members they're taking care of. And we talk about this a lot in resiliency, is family is going to come first. When things hit the fan, that people, we have this mindset, oh, all the public servants, they're going to be there. They're dedicated public servants. They're not going to leave. They're not going to abandon their shifts. Well, we learned this in Katrina.
Yeah, we did.
A lot of
we?
Officers went home to be with their families. Because at some point, there's only so much you can do to help. And we all know, deep down inside, family comes first. And I saw that, you know. Now, hats off to these guys. They stuck it through, but they brought their family there. And I think had there not been electricity and the infrastructure they had on that microgrid, that those officers probably would have been back home taking care of their family. And, you know, as soon as they get them settled, hey, I'm coming right back to work to do my job. And this gets talked a lot about when we talk about contingency planning and emergency management and in my case, risk management. You know, it's one of the things that we've seen happen in the past, and we know it's going to happen again. And I kind of dub it family to federal. You know, before we get the federal system going, people are going to go home and take care of their families first, then get back to work when they can.
Yeah, that, you know, family is big. When I moved out here to Virginia from Texas, I was single. And I met my wife the first year. We got married the next year. I was working at headquarters ICE, and I was working intel, and I was assigned to our continuity of operations team, where I could, you know, use my secret pass to get into a secret facility up in the mountains of Virginia, and continue operations. Well, when I told my new wife about it, she goes, "Well, what about me?" I go, "Oh crap," you know. So I said, "Well, you go with me. If they're not going to let you in, then I ain't going in either." Good thing we didn't have to test that. What I did is I started looking around for alternatives. What happens to John and Jane Doe, who don't have a secret pass to a secret facility in the mountains, and, you know, where there's protection and food and water and all that other good stuff? What I found was disturbing, and that's what started me on my quest to find out what really should be developed. And that's where I came up with the civil defense, a new style of civil defense. Because, you know, we don't face a singular threat from nuclear exchange with the Soviets. Not anymore. You know, we've got multiple threats. We've got the Soviets. We've got the Chinese. We've got North Koreans. We've got Iranians. We've got ISIS. We've got Al-Qaeda. There's all kinds of stuff that we need to be aware of. So communities who take the all hazards threat analysis to heart, they really should be looking at the grid down scenario from a hostile force or a hostile sun, correct?
Absolutely. And, you know, am I concerned about a man-made EMP? Absolutely. I'm actually more concerned about Mother Nature throwing out a coronal mass ejection, just because it's not going to be regional. It's not going to not only be nationwide, it's going to be a worldwide event.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if it hits our grid, if our grid goes down, everything goes down. Huh. Everything. You know, I got a lot of friends, you know, and I always hate to use the term prepper, but you know what? I'm also proud to use that term prepper. If you're a prepper, then that means you're being prepared.
Yeah, me too. I claim that mantle.
Yeah. You know, there's a lot of people, though, that they think just having supplies, oh, well, I've got 6 months worth of food. I've got a year worth of food. I've got water. Okay, well, that's great. You know, if you live out in rural America and you have a hand pump well and you have a septic system and you've got your food supplies and stuff, you're probably going to be a little bit better off than most. But what about medicine?
Yeah.
You know, disease is going to run rampant. And that's one of the things in my thesis, you know, I talked about was how quickly, you know, how many millions of people in the first week with that electricity, in 1 week, millions of people are going to die.
Yeah.
And that's because they're dependent on medical devices. on durable medical devices. People who have...
Or medicines.
Yeah, medicines, you know, dialysis. When they're not getting power and the batteries die on them, there's nothing else you can do. What are you going to do in 1 week when millions of people die? You know, people aren't going to be thinking about, oh, we're going to bury them. You're going to start having disease. The other thing, too, is we talk about wastewater treatment. You know, when the electric pumps go out, what happens to the wastewater treatment? Well, number one, if it overflows, it's going to usually go into a tributary, because I don't know of a single wastewater treatment facility that does not release its effluent, its treated effluent,
into a water. Exactly.
You know, now what do you have coming out when it's not being treated and it's going into your drinking water?
Ouch.
Yeah. You know, there was an article that came out several years ago, and I wish I would have saved it. It was the city of Dallas or the DFW area was talking about reclaiming and recycling a lot of the effluent that they send down the Brazos River. And in the article, the city of Houston was like, well, time out. You can't do that. If you were to stop all the wastewater release into the Brazos River, we would not have drinking water down here. You know, because that's how much water is being sent downstream.
Oh, no.
Just from our wastewater plant. And, you know, if it's treated, that's fine. But, again, now when it's not treated, when that power's out, you're not being able to chlorinate and do everything that's required through that process. You've got raw sewage going into now drinking water.
Right, right.
And, you know, and it's a cascading effect. So now your freshwater intake is not being treated. And people don't realize, they think, well, I've got a well. And there's no way it can get contaminated. Well, that water has to get into that well at some point. In Texas, if you're familiar, we've got
aquifers.
The Edwards Aquifer,
yeah.
And we have the recharge zones. And some of them are big holes in the earth where stuff runs into.
Right.
You know, and if you got a stream that's now being bombarded with pollutants, and it's not just waste, you know, human waste, you've got chemical waste.
Yeah. That aquifer, you know, would be polluted forever. Because
yes.
There it holds everything, and what it is, a big granite cistern, and if there's contaminants in there, you'll never get them out.
No, because, I mean, the stuff that filters naturally when it goes through the limestone and the sand and the sediment works just the opposite. If it's directly put in there, that stuff the contaminants can't leach itself out.
Wow.
And it's, you know, it's concerning when you start thinking about how everything's interconnected. You know, like I say, you no longer have wastewater. You no longer have fresh water. Well, what about everything else? A lot of your other systems are controlled, your natural gas systems. They're on a SCADA system or, you know, a computer-controlled system that opens and controls valves. And what happens to them when the power goes out and the backup power goes out? And now, you know, you're talking about logistics. And that was one of the most interesting things when I was doing my research studies, was how quickly our logistics systems would collapse in a power outage.
Yeah.
Or just the fact that if transportation stopped, if you couldn't get the fuel to the trains and to the 18-wheelers, you know, what would happen? You know, the American Trucking Association back in 2006 did a study. You know, it says in the first 24 hours, and you can find this in the appendix of my thesis.
I got it right here.
Yeah, delivery of medical supplies to affected areas are going to cease. Hospitals are going to run out of supplies, like catheters. You know, the radiopharmaceuticals are going to deteriorate. Of course, the service stations, we've seen this more time than not, are going to run out of fuel.
Right.
You know, and then within a day, you're going to start having a food shortage. And people are like, well, why food shortages? Well, we're in a just-in-time inventory. You know, I know you remember, and I remember the days of when you had a stock room in back of a supermarket. And if they didn't have it on the shelf, you went to somebody and said, hey, do you still have this in the back? And someone would go back there and look, oh, yeah, we haven't put it out yet. Those days are long gone, because, you know, these corporations want to maximize profitability, and if they're using store space to store product, then that's wasted space to sell stuff.
But not only that, you have people going out and buying whatever they can get and starting to hoard things. And so it's going to fly off the shelf even quicker.
Yes. And you can't get it in. You know, one of the things when I was working with the railroad, you know, if a train was delayed, you know, for more than 8 hours, you know, we were told we need to do anything we can to get those trains running because the customer depends on that shipment getting to the rail yard to be offloaded onto a tractor trailer, the shipping containers, so they can make it to the store in time. Because within hours, I mean, those, when you go scan an item, when it gets checked out and it gets scanned, that computer is doing automatic inventory. And when it hits a certain point, you know, it sends a generated message to the wholesaler or the distributor, whoever's, you know, supplying them that product, saying, hey, we need more. And it's a very, very finely detailed balance of making sure that your logistics are working and are dependable and get there within the allotted times. And there's a lot of the contracts are saying, you know, okay, if I get this product, it has to be in here in so many weeks, so many days, whatever the case may be. A matter of hours, somewhere in the logistics delay can make it to where you're not going to have product for a day or two or a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, same thing. If we have a regional outage, you know, let's just say half of the state of Texas, the grid goes down. Number one, first of all, we talked about money at the start of the show. You know, how much is it going to cost to keep us resilient and keep the lights on? Well, let me ask you this. How much is it going to cost us if we don't?
Trillions.
Trillions. Easy.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of these disasters, especially with hurricanes, here in the mainland U.S., they've usually got power back up and running within 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah, completely.
Sometimes maybe a month at the most remote locations. That's because they've got the outside resources coming in.
Right.
You know, if you cut power, and that's one of the things, you know, the Gulf Coast is such a major hub, not only for petrochemical manufacturing, but for distributing and import and export. So if we're not getting product in, we're not making our own product, we're not making fuel, how do those resources, even if the northern part of the U.S. has access to fuel, it's going to be limited.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, panic's going to set in, people are going to start, just like we see in the supermarkets, they're going to go out and hoard gas.
Yeah.
You know, we saw that here in Texas when Harvey hit. The minute they said they were going to shut down refineries for preventative measures, just, you know, to batten down the hatches before Harvey came in, I was actually buying my wife a vehicle, and I was at the dealership all day and messing with the paperwork. So I wasn't paying attention to the news. When I got there that morning at 10 o'clock, it was a normal day for me.
Right.
You know, I was going in, surprising my wife with the car, you know, come back home, say surprise, happy birthday. When I left that evening, the salesman comes in. He's very apologetic. He says, Mr. West, he says, no, I can't fill your vehicle up. Now, keep in mind, this is a Ford Expedition. It's the extra long with the 5.4. It's 4x4. It's my bug out vehicle, you know,
right?
My scout hauler. It sucks gas.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I only live 27 miles from this dealership, and I was concerned about getting home because I asked him, I said, what do you mean you can't fill my truck up? He said, sir, there's no gas available. I'm like, well, can't you go run down to the gas station down the road? So I'm thinking they have a tank in the back or something. And he's like, no, sir, you don't understand. There is no gas. Have you not been watching the news? And so I finally get my phone out, and I hit the local news channel and on an app. And, you know, sure enough, front page news, gas supplies and shortage after run on gasoline when people were afraid of refinery shutting down. And I thought that was a wake-up call on how quickly events can change.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's amazing that people, you know, we have this ability to close things off that we don't really want to listen to, too. You know, it's amazing as humans. We have that ability, and it, a lot of times it's to our detriment.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I 100% agree with you on that.
Yeah.
And we have this out of sight, out of mind thing. if things are just running along this hunky-dory, then we don't need to worry about it because it's never going to fail. Never going to fail.
This is America. Nothing like that happens here until you get a 9/11. And then, you know, that's a wake-up call. Or you get a Harvey or a Katrina. Or in 2012, we just missed a Carrington-level solar flare, which if it would have hit, it would have knocked out the whole northern hemisphere. How many days did we miss it by?
It was a matter of days. I can't remember how many days, but I remember seeing, they showed the video of it erupting off the sun. And I mean, it's just this huge, huge mass ejection. And, you know, luckily, like I said, it's going the opposite direction. But if the sun would have, been in a different rotation or that coronal mass ejection would have been headed straight for Earth, you're right. It would have been detrimental to us. And there's a lot of people, you talk about EMPs and solar flares, and really a solar flare is not going to do that much. Most of the experts agree that, we have solar flares all the time. They may cause, especially up in the very far northern hemisphere, Canada, that area up there, you're going to have a lot more problems than you are anywhere in the southern hemisphere. And because of that, people, it's a solar flare, it's no problem. Well, it's not the solar flare. It's those large space weather events, those coronal mass ejections that are just going to bombard this planet. And when I was doing my research, when they started going back and looking at the Carrington effect and how it affects the poles, I mean, the north and south poles, they can actually reverse the poles temporarily.
Wow.
Because the Earth is doing this whole rebounding effect. And if you've ever seen a slow motion video of like a basketball or something, when it's hitting the ground, you see it flex inward as the pressures, deform the ball, and then it elongates as it bounces back up. And you see this process go on until it finally retains its round shape and it comes to rest. The Earth is doing the same thing. I mean, Mother Nature has always done that. It has its checks and balances. And when those space weather events hit, when those coronal mass ejections hit, I mean, it really wreaks havoc on our electrical or our electromagnetic fields. There's documentation of the solar storm hit. Again, this is late 1850s, early 1860s, and you have people in the Midwest that are miners, actual mining operations. And they woke up from their tents, picking up their stuff, getting ready to go to work because their aurora borealis was so bright, they thought it was morning time.
Wow.
Well, when you're down in the Caribbean and you can see the northern lights, there's something going on.
Yeah, definitely something going on.
A lot of people, when you talk about the Carrington event, they think about all the telegraph operators that got shocked. There was a lot of that. And the fact that they were able to run the telegraphs without even any battery power, just on the residual power going through the telegraph lines, tells you right there about the enormous amount of electrical current that's being generated. And people are just shoving their head in the sand. Again, I think it's one of those because they've never seen it happen, or at least they don't know that it's happened. Because we've had some minor storms, space weather events come through, and they cause minor glitches. And I believe it was 1998. Don't hold me on the date of that, but in Quebec, had a huge power outage. And a lot of people think that all is either physical weather, like a snowstorm or ice storm. No, that was a geomagnetic storm that took that out. And even blew out a transformer at a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, and affected power in the United States as well.
Yes. And when people tell me, well, our grid can handle something like that, it's resilient. You look at some of the largest power outages in the United States, and they're not even related to space weather events or EMPs. They're a tree limb brushing line. They're a squirrel that got on the wrong transformer, and it causes a cascading effect. So one of the few things I remember from even middle school physics is energy cannot be created or destroyed. And it's just like water, it's going to follow the path of least resistance. So if you get a shortage and it's in the middle of summer in Texas on the Texas grid, where this thing is running 90% capacity because everybody's running their air conditioner, and you have an event that triggers an overload, and you've got one line that's, well, let's just say hypothetically they're all running 90% capacity. All of a sudden you get hit with an event that causes those lines to go to 100 to 150% capacity. Where does that electricity go? It doesn't just dissipate. You know, it's got to find some place to go, and it causes that chain reaction. Just ask Argentina about that.
Yeah, they're a perfect example of grid problems. I think some of that is somebody messing around via cyber.
I wholeheartedly agree with you on that. You know, when you read the statements, the few statements that have come out, you know, they're blaming this on heavy rain events.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either. You know, again, I'm not saying that it couldn't happen because, I mean, we've seen tree limbs cause, you know, regional blackouts.
This has gone on too long down there, though.
Yeah, and nobody's, you know, when you're going to say, well, we're going to have something in 10 to 12 days to release, you know, the red flag comes up. Okay, so something else is going on. And almost immediately they were talking about how the parts of the grid, none of this should have ever happened, you know. All the safety features should have been implemented, should have kicked in, and we should never had a cascading effect whatsoever. But, you know, you look back and you look at what cyber attacks target, especially when it comes into those critical infrastructure, those SCADA systems, where they're the electronic controls for everything. And, yeah, you're going to have repetitive failures of multiple safety devices because that's what they're designed to do. And how many reports have we seen come out on to the, available to the public that have already told us that we have code already discovered in our critical infrastructure systems to include our grid that they don't know, A, how long it's been in there, and B, the last report I read they sent out was they don't know what it's capable of doing. They found this malicious code in this power system, and they don't know what it's designed to do.
And they don't take it out.
No. And now we're escalating.
Crazy. You know, it's like finding a splinter in your thumb and just leaving it there because, oh, I don't know how I got that. Oh, I'll just leave it there. Boggles your mind as to why they're even in the business that they're in, you know, or how they made it that far.
Well, you know, you've worked in government as long as I have, and sometimes I scratch my head and just shake my head and wonder.
Yeah.
You know, and don't get me wrong, there are some wonderful people that work on all levels of government that are, they're, you know, diehard patriots. They're going to do what they can to protect us and our families. But there's those one or two that you just sit there and shake your head and go, what were you thinking?
Yeah. Well, Matthew, we're coming up on the end of our time frame here. We're going to definitely get you back because we need to delve deeper into this thesis of yours. And I'm going to be posting the link for both this article on Pinehurst and your thesis at the bottom of my show notes, which will be available on the website under this episode. So if anybody's interested in finding out more about what Matthew has to say about the various threats, it's a little, I think it's around 60 pages, and those are 60 pages that you will remember for the rest of your life because that is some great information. And I think it should be mandatory reading for anybody in city, county, state, and federal government because that is very instructive in what you have put in there. So, Matthew, if you would, do you have any closing remarks for our audience?
You know, listening to the past guests in your show, you know, there's a lot of like-minded folks listening. And you know what? Get with your city leaders. Get with your neighborhoods. Get with your certs. You know, get with your community. Don't only plan for yourself. Help your neighbors plan for an emergency because you're not going to be able to rely just on you and yourself alone. It's going to be a community effort that any resiliency, no matter what type of disaster it is, it's going to come down to everybody coming together, doing their part to be able to survive. And, you know, it's true civil defense that we need to be looking at.
Great. And if anybody who's listening is in the city or county or even state, federal government's position that wants to explore microgrids for their infrastructure, we have friends who are in that business, and we can send them your way. All you have to do is contact me, and we will make sure that somebody with the expertise gets a hold of you, because we are definitely connected. Just kind of wrap things up. The top-down governmental approach to solve community resiliency problem has failed us. We need a community-based grassroots approach to solve this problem. We are looking for volunteers throughout the nation to pick up the mantle of civil defense for their communities. Let's start the conversation with a guide that you can find on our resources page at civildefenseradio.com. Be sure to check out our regular postings on Facebook, and that's at Civil Defense Radio, and on Twitter at civil_def_radio, where we post information on a regular basis, information about these threats that we see. They definitely have an effect on our safety and security as a nation. And again, I'd like to thank Matt for being on the show this week. And I'd like to thank you, our listeners. I really appreciate you listening to our show this week. So please, be safe, be informed, be prepared, and may God bless you until next time. Goodbye.